Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to all of our listeners. You're listening to the Gist of Freedom, and this is Gary Jenkins. I'm your guest host for this evening. Leslie couldn't be with us tonight. I was going to be on the show. I've done two documentary films. First was titled Negroes to Hire. That was a story of slave life and culture in antebellum Missouri. And the second one I did was just completed. The title of it is The Lane Trail, Stories from the Underground Railroad Along the Western Frontier. And I'll be back to talk about those subjects and those movies probably sometime later in November. Now, tonight we have a very interesting guest, Mr. Jeffrey Dill. Now, we've all heard of Muhammad Ali, the greatest fighter of all times. If you're as old as I am, you might even remember that his birth name was Cassius Marcellus Clay. During 1964, Muhammad Ali converted to Islam. He changed his name from Cassius Marcellus Clay to Muhammad Ali. He had been named after his father, actually. And the original Cassius Marcellus Clay was a famous fighter, just like Muhammad Ali was. Only he was a famous fighter in the 1860s and 1850s, rather than the 1960s and 1970s. Mr. Dill, are you out there with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Mr. Dill, could you tell us just a little bit about yourself, and am I getting your name right?
Yes. My name is Jeffrey Boor Dill. I am an assistant professor of theater at Eastern Kentucky University in Richmond, Kentucky. And in the summers, I serve as a tour guide at Whitehall State Historic Home, which is the home of Cassius Marcellus Clay.
Now, tell us a little bit about the original Cassius Marcellus Clay. I read up on this a little bit this afternoon, and he was a paradox for a Southerner. And where is Whitehall? That's the original home of him. And tell the listeners where that is, and then tell a little bit about why Mr. Clay was such a paradox.
I'd be happy to. Whitehall State Historic Home is just outside Richmond, Kentucky. It was originally located on 2,250 acres of land. Cassius inherited that home from his father, Green Clay, who was an early settler to the Kentucky area. Mr. Clay was very much at odds with a lot of things in his life. His father was a large slave owner. At the time of his death in 1828, Green Clay owned over 100 slaves. When he died in 1828, those slaves were divided amongst his children, and Cassius received some of those slaves. However, in 1844, Cassius freed the slaves that he had inherited from his father, and, according to him, at great personal expense. Slaves brought up a lot of the actual estate value of anyone's personal property, and Cassius said reportedly that freeing those slaves cost him the equivalent, well, not the equivalent, but $40,000, and that was in the 1840s, which was a huge amount of money. Although Mr. Clay was formerly a slave owner, he became an emancipationist. He attended Yale University after he had spent a brief time at Transylvania University here in Kentucky, and he was there exposed to the anti-slavery movement. And despite his slave-owning status at that time, he embraced that cause and became probably the best-known anti-slavery advocate in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s.
Yeah, that was very unusual. The son of a southern slave-owning southern aristocrat being a was not. Now, did you say abolitionist or emancipationist?
He was an emancipationist.
Can
yes.
you tell us a little bit about what's the difference in emancipationist? How did he see? How did he view slavery? And how was this problem going to be solved? Because it was a huge issue at the time.
Because he was involved in the movement for so long, his opinion about slavery and what should be done with it changed over the course of 30 years. But Mr. Clay was an emancipationist as opposed to an abolitionist. An abolitionist wanted to abolish slavery, end it immediately, and not take into consideration what effect that might have on the economic status of the country and the social scene as well. Emancipationists wish to free slaves gradually, making sure that the slave owner was compensated for their financial loss, and also to adhere to the letter of the law. They wanted to end slavery by changing the law of the land. So Mr. Clay wanted to follow the law. An abolitionist would break the law, if necessary, by assisting slaves to run away. Mr. Clay wasn't willing to do that because he wanted to defend the Constitution. And he was particularly interested in preserving everyone's right to free speech. And slavery had a hand in that as well.
Interesting. Now, I've not ever heard of that before. Now, he went to Yale University. Is that where he met the abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison?
Yes. He heard Garrison speak there and was obviously influenced, although his older brother, Cassius's older brother, Sidney, had attended Princeton and was also an emancipationist. So he did have some exposure, even in his early life, to emancipationist ideas, but I think Mr. Garrison really solidified those views. And it still took him until the 1840s to really put his anti-slavery activity into play.
Yeah, it was difficult if you lived and were part of the community in the South to even entertain any kind of ideas like that. Now he had I think I read something about it. He had a friend from childhood who was African American at the time. Can you tell us anything about that?
I'm not sure who exactly you're talking about
there. Well, we'll move on. Didn't he do something to establish a free settlement for people?
Yes, Mr. Clay donated land and money to John G. Fees, who lived in the Berea area. Mr. Clay owned land there and gave John G. Fees land to establish a school for African Americans and actually anyone who wanted to attend. And that later became Berea College.
Oh, interesting. And that was that before the civil antebellum time, before the Civil War?
That was, I believe, in the 1850s.
Okay.
He and Mr. Fee did correspond and were supportive of each other's views on slavery until the mid-1850s, when Fee became more of a radical abolitionist, and Mr. Clay wanted to maintain his moderate stand on slavery. So they eventually parted ways. But Mr. Clay always did admire his strength of character for doing what he believed.
So now, you're a docent at Whitehall. Just tell the listeners a little bit about that. It is a national park historic site, I believe.
It's a state historical.
A state historical site. So, so tell the listeners a little bit about, you know, what you see there in the history of that particular. I mean, we know that his father owned it, but I think there's more to it than just that his father that was his father's plantation.
Yes. Originally, his father had built a seven-room brick Georgian-styled structure in 1798. In the 1860s, Cassius and his first wife, Mary Jane, added on to that and increased it from a seven-room brick home to a 44-room brick mansion. And it has some very, very unusual features for a home of that time, including indoor plumbing and a furnace system. So it was centrally heated.
Oh, interesting. Let me think here. I've kind of lost my train of thought. He was a Republican, I read. That was the early days of the Republican Party. It was a much different Republican Party back then. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about the Republican Party of the 1850s, 1860s, and when did it start?
Okay. Mr. Clay began his political career by being a part of the Whig Party, and he campaigned for his cousin, Henry Clay, in the 1844 presidential election. That was where Cassius started to get into some trouble, because Henry Clay was trying to walk such a fine line between the southern states and the northern states. Cassius became frustrated with his inaction on the issue of slavery. So he started to inject that into Henry's campaign. Because they shared the same last name, people often thought that when Cassius spoke, it was Henry himself who was speaking, or it was Henry's son speaking on behalf of Henry. And Henry kept telling Cassius to gear down on the anti-slavery talk, and Cassius refused to. Henry lost the election and pretty well blamed Cassius for that loss because Cassius kept injecting the slavery question into it. After that, Cassius worked to defeat the Whig Party and experimented with a number of different political parties that were starting to evolve. The Free Soil Party, and then eventually Cassius became one of the founding members of the Republican Party. He corresponded in the 1850s with William Seward, who is also instrumental in organizing that Republican Party. And Seward was trying to get the Whig Party, which was still in existence and still forced to be reckoned with, to get them eased into the Republican views. Cassius, once again, was a little bit more impatient, so he didn't have much use for the Whigs at that time. But Cassius did help to form the party, became a very, very strong supporter of it. And then during the 1860 election, as they were choosing their candidate, Lincoln became the front runner. And actually, Cassius was one of the possibles for a presidential nod from the party at that time. Pardon me. William Seward was actually the front runner. But it turned out that Lincoln was able to draw support to him. He became the candidate. But at the convention, Mr. Clay's name was brought up for a vice presidential slot. Unfortunately, because of the inner workings of the party, they felt that a more moderate candidate on the issue of slavery in the vice presidential slot would be far wiser and easier for Southern voters possibly to accept. So Hannibal Hamlin was chosen instead of Cassius. And then, after Lincoln was nominated, Cassius campaigned vigorously for him.
Interesting. At that time, if you were a Democrat, you were for continuation of slavery, and Republicans were kind of on the fence. Some of them were against it, as I remember what I've read. Would anybody in the South, if you became a Republican, who could vote down there? A lot of was it only the wealthy landowners, or could the non-landowners, could the poor white men vote? Now, of course, women couldn't vote at all, and blacks couldn't vote. And so who was voting for these candidates at that time?
I believe that as long as, as the old saying goes, free, white, and of age, and a male, then you could vote. There may have been some areas of the country where there might have been a literacy requirement, but I'm not really sure about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think probably, you know, within those parameters, that's where the voting pool came from.
Okay, you said that Cassius Clay freed the people. The people that he was he got in the after his father died, the slaves that he got, then and he manumitted them. And what happened to them? Did they stay in the area? Did they work for him or work on his farm? Or what happened to them?
We're not absolutely sure. Local information says that they probably stayed on where they were and then worked for wages. Being a freed slave at that time didn't give you all that darn many possibilities. You always had to carry your free papers on your person, and any white person could stop any person of color and demand to see either their free papers or a slave pass. And if that person couldn't produce that, the white person could take them to the sheriff, and if the situation wasn't resolved, that person, whether they be free or not, could be sold at public auction.
Now, Mr. Clay, I mentioned early on that in some of the things I read that he was quite a fighter himself. And,
yes, he was.
And duels were pretty common at the time. I think Henry Clay had a duel with somebody, his cousin. And so, were there any famous duels, or what kind of activities was Cassius Clay involved in fighting himself at the time?
All right. He did participate in one duel. A Democratic opponent of his in the early 1840s, Robert Wickliffe accused Cassius's wife of not supporting Cassius's anti-slavery views and said that none of her family supported it as well. Mr. Clay, feeling it, a slur against his wife and to himself, then challenged Wickliffe to a duel. Now, by this time, dueling was illegal. And if you were convicted of dueling, you could no longer serve in public office. So this was a very risky thing to do. Ordinarily, you would take your affair of honor out of the state in order to do that, to help hide your trail. But in this case, Wycliffe and Mr. Clay decided on another home in Kentucky, which is now known as Locust Grove, up near Louisville, Kentucky. And it was hosted by the owner of the home, Mr. Crone. The report of the duel goes as follows, that the two gentlemen exchanged shots at your standard 30 paces, and neither one of them hit. Cassius then demanded a second shot. However, the seconds convinced both of them not to continue the duel. So the matter was unresolved, and both left the field unsatisfied. So in that instance, nothing happened. And after the duel, one of Mr. Clay's friends is reported to have said, "Well, Cash, I've known you to cut a string with a pistol ball at 30 paces. Why couldn't you hit fat old Wycliffe?" And Cassius was said to have replied, "Oh ho, but the damned string wasn't holding a gun."
Does make a difference. He was attacked after some of his speeches too. At the time, if you were in the South or in Missouri, border state, you spoke publicly in anything but total support of slavery, you were probably putting yourself at great risk. Did he have some problems after some of his speeches?
Yes, very, very much so. There were two instances where Mr. Clay was involved in some serious fighting. Because he had been attacked so frequently for his anti-slavery rhetoric, he had to learn to use his favorite weapon of defense, the bowie knife. Now, Mr. Clay was a large man. He stood 6'3" and weighed 210 pounds. And, you know, consider that size of a man holding a great big knife like a bowie knife coming after
really?
You. And that would give you some pause for thought. Mr. Clay was speaking out against slavery at Russell Cave Springs in Lexington when a man in the audience by the name of Sam Brown from New Orleans stood up and called Cassius a damned liar and struck him across the face with his umbrella. Mr. Clay went to draw his knife but was pulled back by his supporters to try to avoid the fight. Mr. Brown wasn't done fighting, though. He pulled a pistol from his coat, pointed it at Cassius, and said, "Clear the way and I'll kill the damned rascal." Well, Mr. Clay knew he only had seconds to react, so he turned his left side to his opponent, drew his knife, and charged. Brown knew he'd only get off one shot, so he waited until Cassius was at point-blank range and fired. The pistol ball seemed to have no effect on Mr. Clay, as he proceeded to cut off Brown's ear, gouge out an eye, split his nose, and cleave his skull to the brain. Interestingly enough, Brown survived that. Mr. Clay was taken to a nearby house to examine his gunshot wound, where it was discovered that as he had drawn his knife, the sheath of his knife had slipped up, and the pistol ball had been stopped by the silver tip of his bowie knife sheath just above his heart.
Wow.
So, in that instance, he escaped with a great deal of luck. But in the later part of the 1840s, he wasn't so lucky. There was a constitutional convention in Kentucky at that time that was going to be examining the issue of slavery. Slave owners basically did not want the issue of slavery discussed at all, and Cassius felt that it was his patriotic duty to exercise his right to free speech. He was introducing a candidate for the convention, and as he was doing so, another man in the back of the audience had misheard something that Mr. Clay had said, came up front and asked him to withdraw that question or to withdraw that statement. And Mr. Clay said, "Well, what you were referring to, I didn't say, but since you brought it up, that is indeed the case, and you are the tool of Squire Turner, the opposing candidate. That incensed Turner's son to go up to Cassius and once again strike him across the face. That started another fight. In that case, though, Mr. Clay's arms were pinioned to his side after he had drawn his knife. His knife was taken away from him, and a group of Turner's brothers came up behind Cassius and beat him across the back of the head and the spine with their hickory walking sticks. In the meantime, another of the Turner brothers produced a pistol and placed it at the back of Mr. Clay's head and pulled the trigger three times. But the pistol misfired each time.
Wow.
In the meantime, it's really bad. In the meantime, one of Mr. Clay's supporters tackled the Turner brother with the pistol and threw him under a nearby table to get him out of the action. While that was going on, Mr. Clay had been stabbed, presumably with his own knife, just above the lowest rib on the right-hand side, puncturing his lungs and severing his breastbone. But he was able to grab his knife by the blade and handle, cutting the last three fingers of his right hand to the bone in the process. He wrested the knife away, cleared a path to Cyrus Turner, his initial attacker, charged, and plunged the knife into the man's abdomen.
Oh, my God.
At that point, he raised the knife in the air, slumped down to his knees, and yelled, "I died in the defense of the Constitution of the United States of America," and then collapsed.
Wow.
Both men were taken to the hotel nearby and to tend to their wounds. And it was there explained to Mr. Clay that the entire affair had been a misunderstanding. Mr. Clay knew that he had given Turner a mortal wound, so he sent apologies to Turner. Turner accepted those apologies and sent word back, but died later that day. Mr. Clay lived, of course, but it took him 6 months to recover from his injuries, and they pained him for the rest of his life.
Well, you know, I make documentary films. That would be a heck of a story. Has there ever been a movie about any of these stories?
There have been some attempts. There's been a movie done just recently, I think through KET, about Mr. Clay. But, you know, honestly, we out at Whitehall talk about this a lot, and we figure the best way to do it, because he lived so long and did so much, it'd almost have to be a miniseries.
It sounds like it. You know, and we have a saying back home where I come from, is you never bring a knife to a gunfight. And you know, with this guy, it didn't matter whether the other guy had a gun or he had a gun or who had what. He was ready.
It didn't seem to. And there are other stories where Mr. Clay actually had to defend his house against intruders. And once again, the Bowie knife comes into play.
Well, you know, this latest film I'm working on is about the Underground Railroad here on the western frontier along the Missouri-Kansas border. And one of the reasons that people had to get out of Kansas was a free territory, but they still had to get out because of the fugitive slave law. And that was part of the compromise of 1850 I think Henry Clay was one of the primary movers and shakers. Can you tell us anything about that?
Not a whole lot. I do remember that he was not pleased about it at all. And I think that's one of the reasons that he worked so hard to actually defeat Henry Clay in any way that he could and defeat the Whig Party, because they were making all of those compromises.
Yeah, that slavery, from what I understand, they kept compromising and compromising until they couldn't compromise anymore, and then we finally had the Civil War. You know, what else was going on during these years? The westward expansion and the gold rush and of 1849, and there was just a lot going on. Did Cassius Clay have anything to do with any of that?
Not so much of that. When he became ambassador to Russia, under Abraham Lincoln and Johnson and Grant. He did play a role in an attempt to run a telegraph from basically from Siberia over to Alaska. But unfortunately, the transatlantic cable had been finished first. So he would have been probably remembered for his part in that, but it didn't work out that way. And that's kind of sums up Mr. Clay's life, is that he never reached the high office that people would remember someone for. But he was always part of, a very big part of, trying to get things done, and did a lot of moving and shaking in order to do that.
Yeah, you know, another thing I just happened to think of, we have a similar situation here in Missouri. We had an abolitionist or emancipation. He was probably an emancipationist. He's never really been classified, and he had a newspaper in a small town just outside of Kansas City, and it was just across the Missouri River from Kansas, and he was a free soiler, basically, in the 1850s, as they were trying to decide if Kansas was going to be free or slave, and he had a lot of trouble with other Missourians, even though he was a well-respected big businessman for the area and the county that he was in, and he had a lot of trouble. Mr. Clay, I believe he had a newspaper. How did that go down, and what kind of news did he print? Was it a free soil kind of a newspaper?
Yeah, Mr. Clay operated a newspaper in the 1840s. He began it in 1845. It was called The True American, and it was the only successful anti-slavery newspaper to be published in the South. It was published in Lexington, but he did have a good deal of trouble with that. After just a brief time publishing in Lexington, the citizens of Lexington found it offensive because it was a strong part of the slave power in the state. The Bluegrass region, the central part of Kentucky, was where most of the large slave owners in Kentucky lived. And as a result, they found the paper offensive. So after an editorial that Mr. Clay had written, which was misinterpreted by these people, they formed what came to be called the Committee of 60 to shut the paper down. They tried to convince Mr. Clay to voluntarily shut the paper down, and Mr. Clay responded by buying two small brass cannon to defend his newspaper office with, buying Mexican pikes and furnishing his employees with weapons to defend the newspaper office with if a mob should attack. He also said that he had rigged the building with a keg of gunpowder and a hatch through the roof.
Wow.
So that he could escape through the roof and blow up the building should it be taken over. Fortunately, none of that happened. When the Committee of 60 really began to agitate for him to shut the paper down, he was ill with typhoid fever and could hardly stand up, let alone defend himself. So eventually, the Committee of 60 convinced a judge in Lexington to develop what would be known as a bogus court order, closing the paper down, saying it was a threat to the community.
Oh, yeah.
And eventually Mr. Clay had to surrender the keys. The Committee of 60 then packed up the printing presses and sent them to Cincinnati and put them in storage. Mr. Clay, of course, was very upset about this and waited for several months and made them pay the storage fee on the equipment, because if they didn't pay that fee, then they would be liable for any damages for the equipment.
Yes.
And eventually set the paper back up, printed it in Cincinnati, but kept the dateline of Lexington.
Interesting. What about, we've been talking a lot about Mr. Clay, and What about Whitehall as an attraction? For what will people see? Can you tell the listeners what they're likely to see if they would visit there?
Sure. Pardon me. They'll see a magnificent example of Italianate and Georgian architecture. The main hallways, all of the ceilings on the first floor of the new addition are 16 feet tall, and there are nearly floor-to-ceiling windows in the great drawing room. And, you know, the light flooding in there is gorgeous. We have a surprising amount of pieces of furniture and artifacts from the family. We've been spending the house open to the public in 1971. Let me tell you a little bit of background about what happened to the house after Mr. Clay died. He died in 1903, and then his home and furnishings were put up for auction. A grandson, Warfield Bennett, bought the house at the 1903 sale, but didn't live in it because it was sort of run down. So instead, for the next 60 years, he rented the house out to tenant farmers who lived in two small rear rooms and then used the rest of the first floor as a barn.
Hmm.
Tobacco, grain bags, even chickens were kept in that area of the house.
So I guess it's been somewhat restored since then.
Yes. In 1968, the house was donated to the state, and then the state fully restored it. There's beautiful plaster work on the ceilings. As I mentioned, probably about 30% of the furniture in the home belong to the family. We have wonderful artifacts that belong to Mr. Clay. We have two cameo portraits of Tsar Alexander II of Russia and his wife, the Tsarina Marie. We also have a portrait of the Tsar sitting in basically a troika, a sleigh, pulled by a Russian Orlov. Mm-hmm. And this was done by the Russian artist Shverskov. That was given to him by the Tsar himself. We have some of his Bowie knives. We have one of the two small brass cannon that he used to defend his newspaper office with in Lexington. So we've got wonderful artifacts. We have a beautiful home that you get to see 90% of. About the only thing you really don't see is some of the basement rooms that are and probably were basically storage at the time Mr. Clay lived there.
I noticed you do some special events around there. I think you just had one for Halloween. And what other special events do you do there at the home?
We have a Victorian...
What was the Halloween event? That sounded interesting.
That's the Ghost Walk at Whitehall. The premise of the Ghost Walk is that once a year, around Halloween, the spirits of the Clay family come back to tell their stories. So what I do is I write short scenes based on actual historic events. Then students from Eastern Kentucky University's theater department put on historic costumes and perform those scenes, oftentimes right in the very rooms where the events happened. And also I try to put in as much as I can the actual words that the Clays used from letters and other documents that we have. So you go through the entire house, and usually there are about 8 rooms where scenes occur in. Then we'll also recreate events, one outside, for example, the duel that Mr. Clay had. So that's the Ghost Walk.
Is there anything coming up?
Yes. In December, with the first 2 weekends of December, we'll be having a Victorian Christmas at Whitehall. With this event, it's a nighttime tour. It's self-guided, so you can stroll through the mansion at your leisure and look at all of the artifacts. And we also decorate the first 2 floors in the typical Victorian manner. We also explain some of the traditions that began in the Victorian period concerning Christmas that are still celebrated today.
Now, is for the people that that can't maybe can't get down there, are there any good books out there you'd recommend to learn more about Mr. Clay and his adventures in Whitehall?
Yes. There are a number of books written on Mr. Clay. One that you probably shouldn't read until you've read some of the others are his memoirs. And those are available on Google Books. Because it was a limited edition, it was kind of a vanity press kind of thing that he had printed up and sold by subscription. So the originals are difficult to find. Berea College did a reprint in the 1960s of his memoirs, and now those are getting kind of scarce. But it's real nice that Google Books has that online. Some of the other books that are out there, I believe the author's name is Richard Smiley. That book is out of print, but oftentimes you can find old library editions fairly inexpensively. That one is called The Lion of Whitehall. There's another book called Freedom's Champion by Kevin McQueen. He's a former tour guide and works at Eastern Kentucky University in the English department. Then there's Firebrand of Freedom by Richardson. That one, there's some good information in it, but there's also some inaccurate information. In 1952, William Townsend, who is a local attorney in Lexington and a historian as well, gave a speech at the 1952 Civil War Roundtable in Chicago about Cassius, and he called that the Lion of Whitehall. Unfortunately, Mr. Townsend never intended for that speech to be a scholarly piece, but rather something to entertain. And he himself says that he never let the truth get in the way of a good story. So, what he did was to build on the personality of Mr. Clay and may have exaggerated some of the things that Mr. Clay had done. So those are things that we've gone through and tried to find documentation for, and some of his stories we can't find documentation for. I mean, there's one in particular where in Russia, Cassius was supposed to have had an affair with a Russian ballerina and had a son.
Now that makes a good story, doesn't it?
It does. And now, he did adopt. He did adopt a Russian boy, but we have no earthly idea who the parents were. He, in his memoirs, states that in 1866 in St. Petersburg, a city of silence and infinite intrigue, a baby boy was born. As to the true parents of that child, he wrote, I am the only living witness, and I of all men should know best of all, but I'll take that secret with me to my grave. He did indeed adopt the child and changed his name to Lonnie Clay, but we have no idea who the mother was or if the child was his born out of wedlock.
Well, you never know. Those kind of the entertainment news of the time. Some things are don't ever change, do they?
You know. No, and Mr. Clay was once again brought back into the public view when he was 84. He had divorced his first wife in 1878 after 45 years of marriage. But then when he was 84, he took a new bride, 15-year-old Dora Richardson.
Oh, wow.
And boy,
that is for the Entertainment Tonight news.
Yes, it is. And you know, it's shocking how little things have changed. You know, the New York papers had a field day with that.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. That is really interesting. Mr. Dill, I see that our time has come to a close. We had a great show. Could you give the listeners your contact information, like your website and emails, if somebody wants to contact Whitehall and get more information?
Sure. sure. Probably the best thing to do is to go to the Kentucky Parks Department website, which is, gosh, I think it's www.ky.gov.
This is ket.org. There's a www.ket.org.
Is Kentucky Educational Television.
Oh, that's the television.
You can probably find some links to Whitehall from there.
Okay.
But if you type in Whitehall, two different Whitehall,
okay,
Kentucky, that should give you the information to get to our website.
Okay, good. All right, well, I appreciate you being on here, and it was most interesting and enlightening. I learned some new things. I've been studying this time period in Missouri for the last several years, and I'd never heard of an emancipationist and that term, and it describes a lot of people that they just didn't use that term. So I appreciate it, Mr. Dill, and
I
bid you good night.
Thank you very much, and have a great evening.
You too. Thank you. Well, that will be it for the show. Thanks, folks.